Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
This and his life is Owain Arthur, who plays the part of Dwarvian Prince Durin the Fourth in Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power series on Amazon Prime.
Each time you get that phone call saying you've got the job, that is a buzz anyway. So to have it to knowing that this was the biggest project I will have ever worked on. It was quite massive. And I remember calling. I called my mum and dad and sister. I put them all on a group chat and told them what was happening and that I was off to New Zealand and stuff. And that felt good. That was a nice feeling. It kind of felt like, it did feel like a life-changing moment. You know, it is one of those jobs that you just go, oh my Christ, this is massive. And the buzz I got from that was quite spectacular. But then since that, you kind of go, right, I've got to do it now. You know, I've got to produce this now. So it was just kind of knuckling down and working hard and making the most of it, living each moment, knowing what I've got, knowing how lucky I am, and not taking anything for granted, because you know I'm getting on a bit now. I've been an actor since I was 11 and had these kind of life-changing jobs that kind of move you up a bit or give you a bit of recognition, if you like. So each time that happens, I try and gain perspective on it and what it means to my life and how fortunate I am and also kind of taking in that, you know what, you worked hard for it. You've worked at the Albert Hall. You've been a labourer. Not that I've had it that bad, to be honest with you. But you just kind of, I try my best to put things in perspective and also take everything with a pinch of salt. It is ridiculous having all this security. It is, you know, ridiculous going on these press tour and getting clothes thrown on you and stuff. But I've
clothes. What yeah. clothes are thrown at you?
Well, you get like people who decide what you're going to wear and stuff.
Oh, I see. Stylist. I thought you meant the fans were throwing knickers at you or something. Like...
No, that's Tom Jones. I'm nowhere near Tom Jones.
You weren't born too far from him, I don't think.
It's true.
Today, 15 questions to Angela Scanlon. Now, I like Angela. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh, that's just
got
say
that's,
yes.
That's got to have come. Oh no, really? It's not a piece of advice from your Joyrider book. Okay,
oh, sorry, well, give us that just... should be. Yeah, no, I thought it was advice from somebody else. I'm not in sales.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Tim,
go on, do that, and then give our listeners some advice from your book. So go on. What's okay? Fine. Just say yes. So, who gave you that?
Just say yes. My mother actually. Brilliant. She used to always kind of say, "Yeah, you know what? Just say yes and figure out how to do it later." And I always thought, "Ooh, it's a bit risky, and it's a bit cheeky." But it all actually, I think there was a deeper kind of, it gave me permission to figure things out as I went, kind of to go, yeah, okay, there's a confidence on a base level from somebody who knows me implicitly that I can manage this. And so I think it's kind of stood to me pretty well career-wise. And also I think you should jump before you're prepared.
I did a podcast recently on luck, and the bottom line is people who say yes and open themselves up to opportunities are the ones who are lucky. So if you walk around going, yeah, I'll do that, I'll have a go, I'll have a look and I'll see. And they're the ones who get all the luck. The ones who sort of go, I'm not doing anything, I'm not coming out of my house, are the ones who don't get lucky. So
that combines with a little bit from the book, is that idea of perfectionism being such a like thing that stunts people from saying yes, because they're afraid to be seen or to be judged or to be criticized. And so you might have the opportunities, but you're too afraid to take them. And so you sit there, you know, criticizing other people and hating yourself for not doing
it. Go on then, expand. What is that bit in your book then?
It's exactly that. I spent years being like that kind of idea of perfectionism. And I thought it was quite, you know, cool to be a perfectionist. It made you, you know, like detail orientated and very exacting, but actually it's really debilitating and it's really shit because it's a protection thing. You've hide behind it. Nothing is good enough, which is essentially I'm not good enough, you know? So you kind of go, no. Conditions aren't right. People aren't right. Team isn't right, whatever it might be. And it's just a way of protecting yourself from failing or from realizing that you're not perfect, I think. And so I kind of last year, and the book was a big part of that, was like, do you know what? I'm going to do things that I don't feel 100% confident in, that I don't feel like I might not be the best at this, but I won't die. And actually, it's been quite liberating.
Today's hour, I'm curious to know what it's like to be Ben Miller. I thought that was a really catchy title. I was trying to think curious about what curious, because you know I'm labeling all these curious, and I just think I'd be curious to know what it's like to be Ben Miller, because I really like him.
I usually do sort of podcasts and recording. I've got a little, you know, hut out in the garden. I go and sit in there. It's where I go and write as well. I thought, actually, because I'm alone in the house today, I'd move everything. I treat myself. I'd move everything here into the kitchen. I've got the dog with me. I've got the fire going. I just couldn't be better, really.
Nice. Oh, great. Nice, relaxed environment. So
Can you hear that crackling there? Can you hear the fire crackling away there?
I can't, but I'm visualizing it. So I can visualize. It feels very warm. What's coming across, the energy from you is warm. You talk about writing there. Last time I saw you was on Sunday brunch, and you were just releasing The Night We Got Stuck in a Story. Yes. Writing children's books has become quite a big thing for you recently, hasn't it? It's become one of your
things. I mean, I suppose it's that and acting now. Yeah, I mean, I really, really love it. I mean, I didn't know quite what I was getting into when I started doing it. I mean, I had a kind of, like a lot of us, I mean, who doesn't think when they read a children's book, who doesn't think maybe I should write a children's book? But of course, in real life, that's a bit of a different experience from what you might expect. So first of all, the first main difference, the big surprise for me was you then go and meet a lot of children. So you then go on, at least when I started doing them, you did, you know, there was a period obviously during the pandemic when there weren't many school visits, but I've just been doing that for the last couple of weeks, going around schools and meeting kids. And that made a very different, that took things in a very different direction for me, because I started writing for my own kids, but then meeting my kids are real, but you know what I mean? Real kids. Because mine aren't real. My other kids, meeting real kids, and hearing what stories they're interested in, hearing how much they cared about the stories they were reading, realizing from talking to the teachers how important the whole process of getting kids of this age, 7 to 11, to read, is suddenly it was a bit like I kind of sort of, I bucked myself up a bit and I thought, wow, and I really have to take this seriously. You know, that I'm not just writing these books for myself and my own children. There are real kids out there for whom this stuff is really important, you know, for whom this stuff whatever you might teach, you know, want to teach them about in a book. I try and sneak as much science in as I can. I try and sort of get as many, introduce them to classic stories. So The Night We Got Stuck in a Story is really a sort of retelling of Beowulf, and it mentions Beowulf a lot in the story. Try and get kids familiar. Try and get them learning is one thing, I suppose. The main thing is to grab them, make the story really exciting, make the story an adventure. Because I don't know about you, I really like the stories that I read as a child that really took me somewhere. Things like Treasure Island, and I remember a great one called King Solomon's Mines, where they're all going off to find the treasure of King Solomon. I used to find that stuff really exciting. So I want to kind of write exciting adventure stories that really grab them, but where they're actually going to learn something at the end of it.
Curious about what it's like to be a professional dancer on Strictly, and joining me to talk about this is Katya Jones. How much of it is being natural and how much is training? Because I assume that there's an element in the fact that you're like any sport, mm-hmm. you've got to have some talent.
Yeah, but they say talent is nothing without hard work, and it's very true. And I've witnessed a lot of talented people ruin their careers, even in dance, just because they couldn't commit, or they were not mentally there, or not enough discipline in them. So I think, not to blow my own trumpet, but the reason why I've succeeded at dancing is because there was a balance of talent and hard work and dedication and perfectionism and charisma as well, you know, which you can say, you know, you're born with or not.
Yeah.
Which is quite funny, because I think if you were to ask anyone right now, people would say that I'm such a big extrovert, you know, extrovert, very loud and expressive. But if you ask my mum, she'd tell you that I'm an introvert.
Right.
And as a teenager, I did not talk to her. We would be driving in a car for hours. I never wanted to share my emotions, my experiences. I was very shy. I remember as a teenager, my dad was like, why do you do this duck face? I just get really tight in the face when I danced. Never smiled, had zero confidence. My mum was my confidence pretty much. She'd be like, you are the best. You go do it. And I'm like, no, mum, I don't. Never had belief in myself. So it's something that I had to embrace and learn and sort of own almost, mm-hmm. you know, that no, you are good. Just go out there with confidence. But yeah. It's interesting because it doesn't come across like it at all now. So it was a big journey, but I just enjoyed it and wanted to always do better and better.
I can't imagine that, but I was quite shy as a kid, and people go, what? But I think what happens is when you find your way, you know, you get through your teenage years and you suddenly find your way and you go into an adult and you find what you're good at, mm-hmm. you can start expressing yourself. So, you know, when I'm on TV, I'm all right. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable. And then, you know, if you put me in front of a room of people and stand up and do a sort of like a chat, I'm still uncomfortable with that. Mm. I don't find that the best, you know. So I think once you find your way, you can move away from the shyness, I suppose. So.
Yeah, and I think also just finding yourself as who you are, as a person, as a human, gives you that, content feeling and confidence within you. So even any room I walk in, I feel like, well, regardless of who I'm about to meet, I know who I am and I've done already well, and it gives you that inner confidence. So that's how I feel about it. And actually Strictly was a massive, massive part of that, because up until Strictly we were competitors and I was always very nervous. I wanted to pull out of the competitions. Like, you could ask Neil, he's like, I've had enough of you just being, I would do first dance. I'm like, I can't do it. Because we're constantly under this judgment, you know, you're never good enough. And I never, ever, ever thought that I was good enough, even when we were winning. So Strictly was a big part of actually like finding myself and what I'm good at and crystallizing that.
A guy called Nolan North, who's one of the biggest in the world. He's an actor, he's a voice actor too. And he's kind of pivoted. He still does some, you know, traditional work in TV and movies and stuff, but he's pivoted to working in gaming for gaming companies on video games. He's been in Call of Duty, obviously one of the world's biggest games, Uncharted, which is now, as we know, had a movie just out. He plays the lead character, Nathan Drake. Batman, plays the Penguin. Avengers, Assassin's Creed. I mean, the list is endless here. It's just so many.
One thing I think with on-camera stuff is, and this is an Alec Guinness thing, you create the character sometimes from the outside in. If you're playing a king and you have a crown and a big cape on, you know, it's there's something about playing. I've played a lot of lawyers, and you put on a suit that they give you and a tie, you feel, you exude lawyer, and people are visually seeing that. So it's the one thing that's helps in on camera. Of course, in on camera, I am this, you know, it's very, I'm a doctor, I'm a cop, I'm a lawyer, whatever. Whereas in voiceover, you can be anything. I find it to be freeing. I try to kind of draw to the opposite of that thinking, the idea that I'm here, I can make this anything I want. The context, I when I do any kind of project, sometimes they'll give me just my lines. And I'm like, can you send me the full script? I want to read the other lines. I want to know what I'm responding to, because this is acting 101. It's not acting, it's reacting. It's how sometimes there've been some games even that will do this where they'll play the line that the other actor, if they recorded before me, they'll play that line so I can actually respond to that line, rather than just be reading something. I think voiceover directing is one of the a very underrated thing, because a good director feeds you context, feeds you the situation, so you're able to, you know, respond accordingly. Yeah, sometimes it's challenging when you're sitting in here alone. It's gotten easier because of, you know, I've done this for a long time, so I have a range of experience to fall back on. But I have two sons now, 22 and 19, who want to both be actors. The 19-year-old specifically really wants voiceover. He loves it. And I think he's, and my first thing is said, take acting classes. And I tell any person, I meet so many people at conventions and they say, I want to be a voice actor. I'm like, well, why don't you just be an actor? you know, well, I do all these voices. I'm like, well, learn to act with those voices. Because, and I tell everybody, an actor is an independent contractor, like a plumber. And you're never going to meet a plumber who says, I only work on toilets. It's like, oh, I need you to fix my sink. Nope, just toilet. I'm the toilet plumber. Why in a business when it's so difficult and can be so challenging, would you close the door to any form of payment? It's like, give me theater. You know, I tell people an actor's job is to deliver a performance. And whether I'm on a mic or in front of a camera or a live audience, it's the same thing when you break it down. If I'm here on the mic and I'm doing a character, like when I do the Penguin, I literally will lower the mic. He has a bottle jammed in his eye in the game and he's all kind of hunkered up. So I will go down and I will do this kind of face. And I'll be, oh yeah, Batman. Because I can't, that doesn't sound the same if I don't do those things. Physicalize, do these things. You know, my favorite parts of voiceover alone in the booth is working with the people. And it's nice, you know, now it's all remote. So I'll be on a Zoom call or a Riverside call with someone and they'll be looking at me, tell me what they want. I'm like, okay. And we work out, we'll try to find a voice. It's like, well, he's kind of a stoner. So he's a stoner like this kind of thing. Yeah, but he's a little younger, so he'd go a little higher. Ha, 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 ha. And now you try to find like that kind of guy at the beach. He's like totally wasted on the waves. And we'll find, you're like, no, it's he's an old man. He's kind of crusty. Oh, so he's older and he's crustier. And wait, no, get rid of the New York. He's not. Okay, so like maybe he's from down Texas and he made his way. It's like an older Matthew McConaughey. All right, all right. And you're like, oh, And I tell people, say, well, I can't do impressions. I'm like, you know what a bad impression is? There's no such thing as a bad impression. Bad impression is an original character. you can quote me on that. You just take, some people are like, I like to try to do a Sean Connery, but I can't. I'm like, well, take that Sean Connery that doesn't sound like Sean Connery, put a little accent on him, and now you got yourself a Southern man who just likes himself some sweet tea down by the river. it doesn't matter. It's use the visuals, use the context. It can be challenging, but the hardest part of voiceover is like what you said. Sometimes you're all alone in a booth.
Joining me is British snowboarder Amy Fuller. Tell us about the two P's, because you're sort of talking about it there, perspective and practice. You talk about that, the two P's.
Yeah, I think perspective in life is so, so important. And I think it's constantly referring back to what matters to you in life, and then constantly pulling out of a situation and looking at it and going, you know what, really, how much does this matter? How much is this going to define me? And it's about being, you know, okay with certain situations as to when to walk away, or knowing, you know what, I did my best today. It wasn't where I wanted to be, but, you know, I'm not going to punish myself for that. So for me, perspective is really, really important. And I think in approaching anything, if you know you've given it your all, you can kind of walk away from any situation with your head held high and use whatever was learned in that situation to drive whatever the next thing you're doing forward. Because in what I do now, my theory is you're only as good as your last job, because that's what people are looking at. So if I know, you know, I went into the Winter Olympics for BBC, BBC Three, punditry, the full shebang, the podcasting, and I know I gave it my all, that then all I can do is walk away with my head held high, and I'm going to take that experience with what I learned there, and I'm going to channel it and inject it into whatever comes along next. And then for practice, I think this is definitely something which really lands with a lot of people, and it's too true that practice is the key to any success. And that's where I talk about the building blocks of progression, which can be utilized in any format. So let's use public speaking as an example. If you're to practice your ability to speak within your own comfort blanket, the more you can do that, whether it's standing like a lemon in front of a mirror with a hairbrush and rehearsing that speech that you're going to do at work, if you don't have the ability to do that and you're not comfortable in your own skin and your own environment, it's going to be very hard when you actually take it to action in front of people. So I think practice, whether it's in sport, whether it's in the workplace, whatever it is, it's about not being ashamed to put in the hard work. So then when the lights are on and it's go time, you're comfortable in that environment. And you can truly enjoy the experience rather than being petrified of what people might think.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
It's 15 questions to Harry Hill. I really like Harry Hill. I think he's a really good bloke. Harry, thank you for joining me today. How are you?
Sorry, I'm just fascinated by the increase in energy when you turn your microphone on, Tim, because we had a little preamble before where you were, I'm just going to take about an hour. These are the questions I've done. It's like when you phone up, if I'm doing a tour date, right, and in Stoke or something, they say, oh, you know, can you go on the Stoke breakfast show? And it's the same thing. You phone up and you say, hi, Harry. Yeah, thanks for coming. Oh, okay, we're just going to put you on now. Hi, everyone. It's Harry. Let's see.
Harry, it always makes me laugh when people go, do you know what I like about your show, Tim, and what you do is you come across like, and you're just really very natural. I thought, no way. If you actually met me in real life, yeah, I'm monotone, I'm boring.
That's true, everyone. I remember having one of my favorite reviews of a radio show I did was, it said, a half an hour of forced jollity. And I thought, there's a few of those around.
Yeah, there is. All right, I love your book, by the way. I told you that when I met you, there was a good lot of biographies out. Yours was very, very honest, and that's why I liked it. Not only did you talk about all your successes, which are many, you also talked about your failures.
Yeah, the flops. Well, it's funny because my mum phoned me up and said, oh, you know, why just put yourself down in the book, you know, all this. And I think that, you know, your successes speak for themselves. Everyone knows about your successes. And the odd thing for me actually is because although when you have failures, to you, they're like the most important thing in the world. And they kind of, you know, you get dragged down by them at that time. But what I found is that on the whole, people just tend to forget about the... about those sort of things that haven't gone quite how you'd hoped, weirdly. I don't know if you found that.
Yeah, what I loved about your book the most, though, is how hard you've tried to do this. It's been a real... and I always say, everyone who's ever made it, it's been a real slog for everyone, hasn't it? You know?
I mean, I think I've had quite an easy ride compared to a lot of people. But yeah, I was very motivated. And I make this point in the book that it's not necessarily the funniest people, the most talented people that get on. It's the most pushy. And certainly when I started out, I was so pushy. You know, I was, I can remember doing a gig in, I was booked to do an open spot. So that's like 5 minutes unpaid in Birmingham in the winter. And I got the train to Birmingham and it was thick snow, right? And there were I couldn't get to the bus to the gig. So I walked to the gig, which is like 5 miles or something from this, trudging through the snow. I got there and the guy says, oh no, it's, you know, we've had to cancel this, you know, because there's hardly anyone turned up. I said, we're not canceling it. We're doing it. Oh, okay. I forced them to do it, even though, you know, I was only doing 5 minutes and wasn't being paid. I mean, I think you have to have that, really. You have to, I think showbiz is very superficially very attractive. And that's why a lot of people go into it, right? But we both know, unless you're either extraordinarily talented, so there's no one else does what you do, which only goes so far, actually. Otherwise, you just got to be really, really, you got to be prepared to knock on doors and get turned down.
It's about failure. Joining me for conversation is Sarah Steen Lebrano, who's part of the School of Life organization, who help people lead more fulfilled lives.
We're all broken. But this is actually how we talk about it in the book a little bit as well. We're broken in the sense that we're not perfectible. And also that things are going to go tragically, fundamentally wrong at various points in our lives. We talk about the kintsugi pots, which I think are making a sort of resurgence into popular culture. These pots that are actually often ritually broken and then carefully put back together with gold paint.
Sorry, there's a couple of words I don't understand. Perfectible. What does that mean? I don't know that word. Does that mean we're not perfect?
I think if you look at, we can't be made perfect, more importantly. Right. I think certain kinds of advertising or relationships to technology imagine that human beings, if they just did the right things, could become perfect. And we think that that's nonsense, that there's something that's fundamentally more broken and difficult about the human condition, which doesn't mean there aren't important things we can do to make our lives better or that we should just despair, but it means that we have to be aware of this fragility.
Right. And what was the other thing you were saying about
the kintsugi pots?
What does that mean?
So kintsugi pots are just a lovely example from culture of this awareness of fragility. They're Japanese Zen Buddhist in tradition, and they are usually these beautiful imperfect pots that are often ritually broken and then put back together very carefully with gold glue, with actual pieces of gold in the glue. So you see the lines of the break very, very beautifully.
Yes, and
we point out that if you look at a lot of examples of art in Western culture, what we see as beauty is perfection, something that's perfectly symmetrical, that's not broken at all, that's, you know, maybe even like the ideal perfect human body or something like this. And that it's important to be able to look at other examples from other cultures where something that is broken can still be beautiful and appreciated and even very highly valued, because it might be that our own culture places too much emphasis on perfection and equates perfection with this very nebulous concept called success.
Paul Brunson is TV host. He's a serial entrepreneur, television host and columnist whose specialty lies in teaching others professional and social skills.
Based on my research, I'd say it's closer to 80, 90% of people lie on dating apps.
I just can't see the point of doing that. But anyway, go on.
But yeah, but think about it. Like, even the smallest thing. So, you know, they'll, you know, take their age down by a year. You know, yeah, they'll take their height up by half an inch. You know, they'll take their weight down by whatever. Like, so almost everyone, right, is to a certain extent. We just have to accept that. But your point is absolutely correct, is that we determine attraction by a multitude of things.
Yeah.
Scent is one, body movement is one, right? You have tone of voice is another. You know, one of the most powerful studies ever done on pheromones, right, talking about scent, was called the, have you heard about this?
This, no.
This white, is called the white, I think you would like this, Tim.
Yeah.
Is what they did is they took a bunch of guys and put them in white t-shirts.
Yeah.
And they kind of worked them out a little bit, you know, and they got sweaty, right? And what they, then they took those shirts and they brought those to a bunch of women, a bunch of ladies, and they had the ladies to sniff the shirts, uh-huh, right? To determine, was there one person that they kind of, you know, leaned towards, et cetera, right? So they did that. That was one control group. Then they let the ladies see the people, right, without the scent, right? That's in a second group. Then the third group is they let them see, they let them interact with them so they could see them and smell them, right? They found that that second group that was only able to see visually were completely off, right? Completely off. They went with what they considered to be standards of beauty. But those who were able to see and smell perfectly aligned with those who could smell, which means that the pheromones were the indicator, right? That was the key. And so your point is valid. Now, what we also have to accept is that we're living in a completely different day and age, and technology now is going to be it. I literally track our usage of dating apps. And if you look at the percentage of people who meet their spouse on a dating app today in the UK and the US, it's roughly 80%. So 80% of people now meet their spouse through a dating app or through, like, you know, Facebook or Instagram, that kind of thing. Whereas just 10 years ago, it was less than 50%. Hmm. 10 years ago, it was, you know, work was high. You go back 20, 30 years ago, it was church was high. Family introductions was high on the list, right? Where that number is going is I see it going close to 100%. So what that means is that A, we have to accept that there will be issues in the connections. Secondly, is technology now needs to catch up. So you're going to see, and I've seen dating apps that try to introduce, they can't introduce scent, but they try to introduce body movement, you know, metaverse type dating.
Yeah.
You know, they try to introduce touch. I've seen like hologram dating and all kinds of crazy stuff. So it is going to be a challenge, and we just have to account for that when we are dating.
Joining me is Scott Herzefitch, who is Director of Law and Ethics Program and Professor of Law and Philosophy Art at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, so the trolley problem, a lot of people, I'm going to tell you like the first story, a lot of people think that's the trolley problem, but actually you need two stories to get the trolley problem going. So the standard story that has penetrated most people's consciousness now runs like this. There's an out of control trolley heading down a track, and there are five workers up ahead on the track, and if nothing is done, it's going to hit those workers and kill them. But you just happen to be standing near a switch. You can pull the switch and divert it onto a different piece of track, and that'll save those five workers. But bad news, there's one worker on the spur, on the additional piece of track. And so if you pull the switch, that worker's going to die, but you'll save the other five. And so most people, not you, Tim, I know, but most people think, I'm gonna pull that switch and save the five, even though the one's going to die. So that's case one. Now, case two, you can do in a variety of ways. It's most commonly done through a version of the story called Fat Man. So out of control trolley heading down the track, it's going to kill five workers. This time you're not near a switch. You're on a bridge overlooking the situation. There's a very heavy man who's leaning against the railing. If you just give him a little tip, he's going to fall over. And you believe, why I don't know, but you believe, you know, that if you push him, he'll fall on the track. It'll stop. His body will stop the trolley. He's going to die in the collision, but it'll save those five workers further on. And then you ask people, hey, would you push the man over the bridge? And most people, like Simon on the Sunday brunch, say, no, I would pull the switch, but I'm not going to push the man. And that's the trolley problem. The problem is, why, when the math is the same, kill one person to save five, are we getting inconsistent answers about what people would do in these situations?
There is LJ Rich, who is best known for presenting BBC tech show Click. LJ Rich is also a journalist, producer, inventor, creator, and composer. But she also has, here we go, I'm going to try and pronounce this, synesthesia. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Synesthesia. That was very good attempt.
Right, okay.
Just the extra S in the middle.
Synesthesia. Synesthesia is a new...
Yes.
Say it for me again.
Synesthesia.
Oh, synesthesia is a neurological trait or condition that results in joining or merging of senses that aren't normally connected.
It is a bit of a mess up there, so I'll try and explain it. When I listen to music, I see in my mind's eye a massive IMAX screen, and on it is a kind of projection of colours and lines and light, which is basically all of the notes in a piece of music split out so that I can read it. So I can manipulate moving it forwards and backwards, querying particular notes to find out, the violin is playing a G, for example. And so I see this kind of movie playing across my mind in colours and sort of blotches and patterns and shapes, and that helps me decode music. And that's always happened since I was tiny. And with food, when I eat food, I hear music, which is amazing. It's why I'm a complete and total foodie. I love eating and experiencing new combinations of flavours. And the other way around as well. So David Bowie's Life on Mars, I've got my keyboard plugged in because I thought I might need it for examples. That's this sort of gorgeous textures of orange and purple. You know, ABBA songs like this. That's like a kind of blue and yellow, which is pleasingly just like the Swedish flag. And listening to formulaic pop music is like eating icing sugar. It's nice. It's not massively substantial, but it's kind of, it does the trick. And things like sushi, that tastes like... it's a sort of acoustic guitar, sort of power chords like that, DNA. That's like a beautiful piece of sushi.
How do things like, what about something like spaghetti, which is sort of a spaghetti bolognese type thing, which is all long and gangly, and how does that manifest itself in sound in your mind?
Weirdly, spaghetti bolognese is like Supertramp.
Dreamer! Oh, that one.
Yeah, I don't quite know why the logical song and spaghetti bolognese go, but I've found that I can play with this sort of mapping and augment my experience of food with music. Like if you eat mashed potato and listen to the Eagles, it's fabulous. And drinking green tea whilst listening to Bach is very rewarding. You get the idea.
With Adam Walker, who went from toaster salesman to swim non-stop across seven of the world's deadliest oceans, wearing only swim trunks, cap, and goggles.
to the cook's tray and I looked up and I thought, oh God, when I was being sick, please give me something positive, you know, ocean gods. And then all of a sudden a fin came flying towards me. It's not like Jaws, it's not slow-mo, they're just there. And then I had 12 dolphins basically barricading me in. I thought, this is absolutely incredible. After 20 minutes, I looked down and I saw a much deeper dolphin moving differently, that as I joke, I had pointed teeth and a different fin, but I didn't see the pointed teeth. So that was sort of tracking me. I got a drink and the dolphins stop, and then I continue. If you want to look at Adam Walker swimming with dolphins on YouTube, you'll see the video. And it barricaded me in, and this happened for an hour and a half. And people say, oh, weren't you scared of the shark? But I had a choice. Do I focus on the dolphins or do I focus on the shark? You know, the warm. Do you focus on warm or do you focus on not warm?
Yeah, I love it.
So I chose the dolphins, and basically it gave amazing. One would circle me for an hour. And what I've read up on since, and I did a documentary where I interviewed scientists on dolphin intelligence, they circle their young to protect them. So one would come, was literally about 2 or 3 inches in front of my hands, no matter how fast I went. And I had one on the side eyeballed me for 10 minutes, and it made me pretty emotional. It was just an incredible spiritual thing, and I wouldn't class myself as a spiritual person. And the amazing thing is all 6 channel swims I did for whale and dolphin conservation. So I was trying to get out there to protect whales and dolphins. And then I have this experience with the dolphins where they're so connected to me. And bear in mind, you know, dolphins are like kids. They'll get bored. You know, I'm very, very slow compared to a dolphin. The dolphin's 30 mile an hour and I'm 4.5 K an hour. So it must have been boring. And there's nothing more demotivated than a dolphin hardly looking like it's moving and you're going as fast as you can. But it was absolutely incredible and something that I felt like almost like a reward for what I'd been through. And then, you know, forgot about the shark, carried on, and it drove me forward to finish the swim. So, you know, and there's an amazing picture if you look online with a dolphin in midair, and all the media around the world said, have you superimposed that? It looks too good, but it is a real picture. So, yeah, incredible.
Today's hour, I'm curious about whether you're thinking clearly. Now, we all know none of us are thinking clearly. We all know life is an illusion. It's all about perception. We all know our thoughts are full of bias, and we have ridiculous thought processes, but we're just human and we're just trying to stay alive. That's kind of the deal, isn't it? You're here and you're trying to set your very, very few, very small amounts of control over what you're doing. It's all sort of like you've got an inbuilt computer which is navigating you through, and some of these thoughts are a little bit wayward. Anyway, Marian Franco and Matt Warren have written a book, Are You Thinking Clearly? 29 Reasons Why You Aren't and What to Do About It.
There's a vast array of factors sort of competing for your bandwidth, your mental bandwidth and your attention. And it's kind of remarkable that any of us manage to function at all. So, as you say, I think we're all doing a wonderful job, and we all think chaotically sometimes, and we all get muddled, and we all make stupid decisions, and that's totally normal. We're not trying to come up with one quick fix, but rather telling people about some of the factors that may be doing that.
Yeah, I think one of the big things I thought whilst reading your book is when you realize that you're not actually really in control of yourself or your thoughts. You know, I mean, I can't tell you what I'm going to think next. It's just come. And where's that come from? It's come from programming from years, my parents and my society and the news, the media and everything else. And also, I suppose there's a little bit of me in there. I don't know which bit is me, but there's a very small bit. But I'm not really in control of what's coming into my head. And I think once you realize that you're not really in control of what's coming into you, it's kind of a bit of a release. Because when I do have some bad thoughts, which I know I never do, no one ever does, but sometimes when I do, I think, well, maybe that's not my fault. Maybe that's programming from a long time ago or something I've witnessed or something I've seen. And how much do you think we have free will, and how much is it all programming, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the take-home messages from the book is that you can actually change a lot of that. Like if you are, for example, when something pops into your head, it might be based on a gut feeling. And it's just like a really strong feeling that this is right. And you don't really know why, because you haven't thought it through properly. But if you kind of know yourself, your emotional history, your sort of habits of thinking, you can sort of understand better where that feeling is coming from. You know, I've always had this experience, like if I've always had a really hard time with people, maybe, you know, I've been bullied or whatever, I might have sort of a pessimism about people that might all like lead me to interpret the situation in a certain way. Like if you can understand these little things about yourself and your history, sometimes when a thought pops into your head, it makes more sense. So you can sort of try, by trying to get to know yourself better, you can get more insights into why a certain thought pops into your head.
Story of Stephen Johnson, Managing Director, Cooker, UK and Ireland. He'll tell you the whole story as he knows a lot more than me.
What astonishes me is how good the product is and how long it took them to get it to market and get people buying into it. And I look at my journey in the UK. I started in 2006 and I originally started, they wouldn't buy me a car at the time. I think they gave me a hire car and a brochure and said, we'll see how it goes. You know, if you do well, you'll get a car and you'll be here. And I went traveling the country with my brochure going to see people. And I think half of them have thought I've lost my marbles. This man sold his company and he's now found this product and he's gone bonkers. And I'm, as I say, 16, 17 years in and people still trying to understand the concept and what it does. It's amazing.
Just picking apart a bit of this, how close is it to, as a business, to, it was custom furniture you were doing with your dad, wasn't it?
Yeah, office and kitchen furniture.
How close is that to going in and trying to flog a brand new invention that no one knows about?
Completely different. One of my frustrations or one of the challenges in a kitchen business and an office business that we have is trying to please your customers. So you buy an expensive kitchen, it's got multiple component parts to it, different design schemes. So a customer doesn't always appreciate what they're going to get in a kitchen. So it's sometimes quite challenging to deliver something where they go, wow, it's exactly what I wanted, because it's such a complex area, kitchens, bedrooms, bathrooms, and it's so subjective. And I might explain to you something that looks like this and you have a vision that it looks like something else. So kitchens, bedrooms and bathrooms are a really challenging industry to work in to satisfy customers. What I found with Kuka is it's a product that does, there's no ambiguity with it. You're buying it. It's a tap that delivers boiling water. You can't oversell it. So it absolutely amazing product to sell. I couldn't believe that I'd have people investing in £100,000 kitchens. And all they spoke about was the tap that has a red light when you turn the boiling water. Just a lot easier to sell the product's USPs and to make the customers happier. But what I would say is everything I learned in my father's business has enabled me to do what I'm doing today. The education I got in there, being able to work in the factory, in accounts, I got to work in every single department and learn my trade in that business. And everything that I learned there has enabled me to make a success of this business. Yeah. And that's why, I'm really keen on apprentices and opportunities for young kids, because I seem, for me, the privileged life I have, but that apprenticeship I served with my father has enabled me to grow this business to what I have today.
What did your dad say when you said, I'm going to go and sell hot water taps?
Yeah, I think he thought I'd lost my marbles as well.
Joining me to discuss this is comedian, podcast host and financial PR person, Victoria Layton. Fascinating story she's got too. You're going to enjoy this.
I did get a bit of a taste of it because I was making people laugh in the little bit where you go around and you do your little laughy bit. And so I tweeted about it again because this is my life. My life is Twitter. We must keep it. It must stay. And the comedian Mark Watson saw my tweets saying, does anyone know how you can get into open mic?
How do you know him?
Just pure like serendipity, basically. I'd got involved in a conversation that he and Katie Brand were having months before. It sounds really convoluted. About making up films with common tropes. So they were like, oh, I'm a PR person that's really glossy, and I'm going to have to go to a far-flung Scottish island where I'll be too glossy for the village, and I'll fall in love with a local grumpy man who secretly is the love of my life. And I joined in because I was like, that's my job, and it's all true. And then they both started following me back, and I was like, this is the best day of my life. But yeah, a few months later, Mark saw my tweet and he invited me to be on his 26-hour marathon show and get over my fear once and for all with him learning stand-up. So, so that's how everyone gets okay. in. It's a boring story, really.
Really boring. That. No, that's a brilliant, cliche, boring story. Matt Watson's lovely, by the way. Such a lovely bloke.
he did not realise 4 years ago when he did that he was going to be stuck with me for the rest of his life.
Right, though. Okay.
I literally made him open one of my shows in Edinburgh because I wanted to know what it would feel like with people in the room. I was like, please. My flyer couldn't sell it either. She was flyering going, oh, Vic Slayton's show when Mark Watson's going to do a 10-minute set at the start. And they were like, yeah, right.
Curious about how to have better conversations. Joining me is Nihal Arthanayake, who has written a book all about it. Conversation is an art form, and sometimes we're losing it, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we are fooling ourselves that a WhatsApp group is connection, and it isn't connection. Connection, even though it's through a screen, is what you and I are doing now.
Yeah.
And it'd be even better if we were face to face as we were in the Sunday brunch studio. But connection should not be undervalued or undermined. It's really important that when we go and sit down for lunch with someone, Tim, or dinner with someone, we don't put a mobile phone on the table. Put it away, man. Put it away and focus on the person in front of you. Don't tell that person opposite you that your opinions, your thoughts, your feelings are only as important as an Instagram notification. Because that's essentially what you're saying if you put the phone down next to you. And interestingly, a friend of ours, after reading my book, she went out for lunch with another friend of hers. And while our friend Zoe didn't put her phone on the table, put it in her bag, the other person put the phone on the table, and Zoe immediately noticed, in a way she hadn't before she read the book, how distracted this person was.
Yeah.
Right? It's quite simple. I'm not asking you to throw your mobile phone away. I'm not a Luddite. I love my mobile phone. But what I am saying is understand the impact it's having on you and act accordingly.
Today's hour is 15 questions to Alistair Green. Alistair Green is an actor, writer and comedian. I became aware of Alistair through his short one-man sketches he posts on Instagram and Twitter.
About 2019, something like that, I had a lot of ideas for sketches and things like that. But to make something, as you know, if you work in television, it's a big job to make even a small sketch of 2 or 3 minutes. You've got to get, you know, at the minimal amount, you've got to get a cameraman, a sound man, you know, you've got to get, well, you might arguably you need a director and a producer and all the rest of it, blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, well, why don't I just do one on my phone, which is what I did. And I always had this idea for a while of some of the characters that do a very, 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 very small detail, like as in a very minute detailed character thing that I tried to do live a couple of times, and it was fun, it went well, but it was like, no, I want it to be so nuanced and so small that you see it up close. And then I just kind of really, it was accident. I just did one on my phone and I thought, should I just post this online? This was in 2019, something like that. So I'd already had, and that really was, as soon as I did one, it changed everything. I thought, oh, right. And even now, I haven't had a single idea that I couldn't film on a phone. There's nothing you can't film on a phone. Or on the smallest device you have available. Whatever you have, you can do it. You know, you can cheat the other stuff. Some of the ideas I have are like mad, you know, but then I think to myself, well, So, for example, I've got this one at the moment. I haven't done it yet, but I sort of was messing about with it. Of a guy, you ever been at a barbecue? This will ruin it if I put it out, because everyone will know the premise already. I've got this one called Dad Pretending to Not Be Scared of a Wasp at a Barbecue. You know what I think dads do, where they go, just stop it. Just get it away from you. Like the kids go, oh. He goes, just get it. It's nothing. And then for ages, starts batting around and basically throws a spoon, it breaks a window, and it's just this chain event of things like he catches fire on the barbecue, the house burns down, the whole, and then he just saw the earth blowing up eventually, or whatever, like a stupid joke like that. And I thought, oh, you can't do that. And I thought, well, of course you can. You just cut the footage off YouTube or whatever. You just find the clip of it. It's funnier. You know, you just make it look daft like that. Just a guy's trying to swat away a wasp at a barbecue, and it ends up in this, you know, cataclysmic event.